What's up, guys? Welcome back to Finding the Edge podcast. I'm Garrett Boyum, joined here with my co-host, Brock Hammett. Brock, how are we doing today?
It's going good, man. I guess I can officially announce at this point that I've taken a job with the Milwaukee Brewers, so
I'll congrats.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll be moving to Arizona the start of the year, so I'll be sad to be moving away from Springfield and away from you. But
it's going to be warmer there.
Yeah, no complaints there. Like, I mean, the worst part of winter is pretty much after all the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, after New Year's, it's just like, it's cold for no reason, which is pretty much exactly when I'm like going out there. So I get all the fun part with Thanksgiving and Christmas. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I'm done with that, then I'm out of here.
Nice. Well, what other things you've been working on?
Personally, I've been just, you know, trying to continually keep updated with some of the different skill sets I've learned, with SQL and R, and been doing a lot more, studying into like statistics and probability for statistics, specifically how it applies to like data science. So the past couple of weeks, that's been a main focus for me.
So any interesting or counterintuitive things that you've learned so far when it comes to statistics?
I don't want to say just yet because I still am in the learning phase of everything where mm-hmm. I haven't tried to like apply anything. So I don't want to, you know, make a claim without fully like understanding like a statistical concept, if that makes
sense. Oh, for
sense.
Sure. The one thing that I had more recently learned, and this was actually from Rob Gray's podcast, he was talking about randomization and what does it mean to do something that is randomized. So let's say you're using weighted bats and you're wanting to alternate in a random order. Oftentimes the way that we think of a random order means that we'll go like 1, 3, 4, 2 or something like that. And what Rob pointed out was that actually a random order may actually look like 1, 2, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's because each roll of the dice has the same probability that you're going to roll that number.
Yes.
And so you could have something that would look like 1, 1, 2.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so today when I was doing my plyo throws, I did one set of all four. I normally alternate the balls that I use to create some level of variability when I'm throwing. And today I decided, well, in the spirit, I thought I was doing random. Like, and that's what Rob's point was, is that we think we're making something random and we're not. Because mm-hmm. when we do random, we'll use all four of the implements or the numbers.
Right.
And then, whereas today I went and I downloaded a random number generator mm-hmm. and I got a bunch of ones, which I had labeled gray 1, yellow 2, red 3, and 4 being the blue. And I got so many ones and twos, I only rolled 2 4s. And that was probably after like, it was 8 throws in that I actually got a 4.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting from the standpoint of, I actually liked it because in your mind, you always want to grab a different one. And you're always like, well, when should I switch to the next ball?
Mm-hmm.
And you just roll the dice and it'll tell you. And so it takes some of the thinking out of it. But I think as a coach, I was talking with another coach about it today. And where I was basically saying that sometimes, though, if you're not getting enough of the roles of like the implement that you want to have them use, sometimes you can just override it. Or I thought about even just switching, since I was getting a lot of ones, just switching the 4 to a 1 and then doing it that way. So those could be some ways that coaches could utilize a random number generator, because I got like a lot of 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 2, 1, 1, something mm-hmm. like that. And so that's how a coach could utilize a random number generator.
No, that's really cool. Like one thing you could do is just like, you know, whatever. I don't know exactly what the application that you're using. Like,
just to create variability.
No, I get that. I'm mm-hmm. just saying like what you could do, because I think you're right, is like, because you want to have like a certain amount of exposure to all the implements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can like set exposure minimums and maximums so that, you know, say I'm always getting exposure to like at least 25% of,
yep.
say I'm going to throw a plyo ball like 10 times
mm-hmm.
or 100 times. And then, you know, 25%, at least 25 of those will be each ball. And you can set a maximum exposure limit yeah. to.
So the other thing that I thought too, and I think that's very good, is just do a set where you get an even exposure to all the implements. And then once you've gotten the exposure that you want, then all the rest of them, you can just go with the mm-hmm. roll of the dice, and then you don't have to worry about it.
Start the baseline
yep.
with whatever you want.
Yep. And then from there, let the rest of them be completely random. And from like a hitting standpoint, I think this would be really good for like pitch calling, for like to expose a hitter. Like, let's say you're doing machine stuff and you want to alternate it in a random order. You could just then use a random number generator. Like, I got a free app on my phone, and you just roll the dice, and then boom, that actually decides what pitch is thrown. You could do the same thing even too with live. That would be my preference, being done with live, which we've talked about. But this week, Lawson, our hitting coach, added something that I thought was really good to with the pitching machine. Even though I don't really like utilizing the pitching machine because it lacks specifying information, which I think we might have talked about on a previous podcast.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead and just clarify for people that might not have listened previously
sure.
what that specifying information is that the pitching machine lacks.
So things that the pitching machine is going to lack is it's going to, from specifying information. So the specifying information that is present, it's easier to talk about that. Ball flight. You're going to have spin and ball flight and movement. Mm-hmm. That's the information that is available to the hitter when it comes to the pitching machine. And the thing that hitters really struggle with hitting off of a pitching machine is timing, because it's so variable with how the person puts it in, all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, it just becomes much more difficult for them to time. Whereas when they're hitting off of a actual live pitcher, the research shows that athletes are able to pick up pre-pitch movement and anticipate where that ball is going to go. And so a pitcher's movements provide specifying information about the pitch even before it's released. And it can be as simple as, to me, as the pitch being high or low, like going to be up or down in the zone, just simply, or maybe even away, mm-hmm. maybe in. Like, it might not necessarily, like, because oftentimes we think about like trying to pick up like curveball wrist position or changeup wrist position. I think that's really hard to do. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think it's easier to notice like how aggressively their front side moved. Because if they aggressively pull with their front side, they may yank across their body and then the ball's going more glove side. Same thing with how the front shoulder is working angle-wise. They can pick up that ball's going to be high. How their front shoulder works and how their body moves towards the plate, they can anticipate up or down. And so that's more what I believe a pitching machine lacks. And having hitters attuned to those variables is really important to giving them an edge when it comes to the game situation. And so, although one of the things I'm currently putting together a research proposal for one of my classes, and one of the main papers I use in that proposal is Pinder and Renshaw's 2009 pitching machine study with cricket bowlers. And they wrote up a follow-up commentary explaining like this is, we understand why pitching machines are used. And they bring up some very good points, and this is why I understand why we're still going to use pitching machines, because we lack enough pitchers. You know, we lack the ability to be able to throw all the time with accuracy, all that sort of stuff from a logistical standpoint. And so if we're going to use them, this is where kind of what we talked about on last time's podcast, thinking about what information is present in the environment for the hitter to attune to. And so what Lawson did was he added with the pitching machine, the feeder is going to have a normal leg kick. And Aaron Meyer, actually, I think he does this very well. I've been watching him do it, and he does it really well because he'll lift up his leg. He'll have his hand right already on the machine to just have the ball right there to go into it, not holding it up and dropping it in. It's just right there. He'll do his leg lift, and then he'll open up, and his chest will turn, and the ball will come out at the same time. And I think that's helped a lot of guys, or I've talked to our players, and they said, yes, this helps us with timing. It makes it actually a lot easier to hit. And, you know, because we also know that getting a projector machine that plays a full pitcher's windup is expensive and challenging to utilize that. This is an easy little fix or tweak to, like, a little easy add that you can utilize when using a pitching machine to make it a little bit more representative.
Right. I think the key there is just to, like, being able to reference, like, a similar type body movement to when the ball comes out. Mm-hmm. So traditionally you just have somebody standing there and then a drop, whereas, mm-hmm. like, you start to get a feel for, like, okay, he does his turn and then he does his lift, his leg lift, and then it drops. And it just gives you kind of a reference point that is might not scale exactly to what it's like to see, like, a pitcher throw, but mm-hmm. it's similar in that you're using a prior movement to kind of get timed up to the release of the ball. So, I like you said, I think, you know, it's a free, you know, add to try to make a pitching machine a little more representative. So that is cool.
Yeah, and so I think this ties in well with Kyle Lindley. I don't know if I pronounce your last name right, Kyle. I apologize. But him and Anthony
Brady
had a discussion that they posted on Twitter about visual gaze strategy. And do you think it's worthwhile to read their comments? Because otherwise I'm going off memory here. Do you have it pulled up and do you want to read it, or should I do that? For at least for context. Otherwise I will just go with memory on it.
I'll go ahead. I'll send it to you right now.
No, I have it. I have it pulled up.
Well, go ahead, and if you just want to read through or just sum it up, then.
So I have to stay close to the mic here. So they were talking about how it may be counterintuitive to evaluate visual strategies in light of evidence supporting non-deliberate decision-making by hitters. And by the way, I'm quoting them right now. If actions are coupled with perception, would changing the hitter's visual strategy matter? So that's kind of their main question within this thread. And so they go on to talk about if coupling of action and perception is subconscious and improved by more exposure to realistic settings, should we ignore visual strategies and just focus on providing more repetitions? So second question, I don't have the answer, but I would assume that it's a combination of the two. I would agree with that. Kyle goes on to say, I would theorize that we can speed up efficiency at which the action perception or AP coupling, I think he meant to say perception action coupling, is developed by identifying more important cues and visual strategies, which improve more visual information to our nervous or neural. I'm going to say nervous system. He says neural, but I think he meant nervous. More and better info equals faster development of the automatic reactive relationship. So I think when we were talking about back to why I really like the pitching machine, and what especially Meyer, but Law's idea of having that is based upon the incomplete research, meaning it was done off of a video screen, not off of an actual. No, they actually did. This other study did actually have a live pitcher, and they were actually standing in the box. What you see is the pivot strategy, and I think Kyle has done research to confirm this, that you pivot your, so you'll start with your eyes fixated on the body, and then it'll pivot to the release point. So by having your feeder go through and do a leg lift and, you know, foot down, body turns, they're going to then utilize some of that information, and then their eyes will start on the body and it'll pivot over to the machine. And so that's a little bit more realistic gaze strategy.
Right.
And I think like Kyle's overall question of, do you need to train hitters to do this, or can you just expose them to it? And I think going back to what Sean Mishka was talking about, asking athletes what information are they connecting to, can give us some insight a little bit, and can also change the athlete's focus of attention to being a little bit more external. And then maybe we can ascertain that a little bit, and help guide them to improving their visual gaze strategy. So that would be kind of my thoughts to kind of what Kyle and Anthony were kind of discussing.
At what point do you try to like introduce a new like gaze strategy?
Well, if we don't have the, you know, glasses to actually track what their eyes are doing, I think it's more of a question of, like a more recently talked about, asking them, what are they seeing? What are they picking up? And from there, just trying to get them to pick up a little bit more of that. Like, so much of the research from the reading that I've done talks about anticipation and the importance of anticipation, and how that really helps with athletes. And so for me, what that means is I want to educate athletes' attention to picking up the subtle differences in the pitcher's motion and trying to utilize that to anticipate what pitch is coming. So especially when you're standing on deck, can you see, and this is what a coach is really good at, right, is looking at a hitter and noticing a subtle difference or change in their movement. And that's usually how a coach decides to intervene with a cue or something else. Teaching players to actually pick up on that, not so much to try to change somebody's mechanics, but actually use that to understand the results that come from that person's mechanics or little information that they're picking up. And so that's where, for me, I look at lead shoulder and how the lead shoulder is working. Maybe I'll look at, you know, angle and different things like that. And so if a hitter can better pick up those little bits of information, like we had previously talked about, I think that's how they would improve their visual gaze strategy, because they're going to start noticing those things more.
I think that's great, just as far as like communicating with a player, mm-hmm. You know, trying to get improvement without necessarily making them change anything, right? Mm-hmm. Just becoming more attuned to the information available. Yep. My question would be, what would you say to, what would your take be on, say, an athlete that maybe he connects to the information well, but he just can't verbalize it correctly or
sure
communicate really what he's seeing? Because I would imagine there's probably a lot of hitters that, you know, they connect to it really well, mm-hmm. but they can't verbalize yep. it or yep. conceptualize it. Would you have any pause, I guess, asking a hitter that seems to be performing really well, like, hey, what are you noticing?
Yeah, I would definitely ask that question. If they don't know, that's totally okay. Because again, you know, if somebody's going well, you don't need to dumb them up and get them like over conscientious. And more of what I tend to do in those scenarios is, to some extent, when things don't go so well, you know, and they're struggling a little bit, then asking the question of like, hey, what do you think, if you're just try to put yourself back and remember, what things do you think you were picking up, or what were you, describe those feelings of when you were going well. And I think that's a question that I kind of struggle with, you know, of like, should I ask them right now? Like, hey, remember how this all felt and this whole process, like just log in the memory and we'll come back to it. So those are like kind of the things that, you know, are running through my mind as to whether or not I would ask. And I think it definitely depends upon the relationship you have with the athlete and how, you know, are they a person that that's very introspective, or are they very much a feel emotion driven in the moment type of a player? And if they're in the moment type of a player, I would just let them be in the moment.
Yeah, I think that's the art of coaching, really, is knowing which conversations to have with which guys and if it's appropriate, if it's not. But I definitely think there's a lot of value to maybe tracking, you know, what you're connecting to when things are going well, when things aren't going well. That way you have something to call back on, you know, if you're in a slump, or, you know, if you're doing good, just to help kind of try to get you to kind of eliminate the valleys of, you know, a natural season of, you know, performance. So I had a, I don't know if I've talked about it here or not. I don't think I have, but I was really interested in like why some hitters are more volatile than others. You know, like Manny Machado, like, had like a month where he was the best hitter on the planet, and then he'll have like months where he's like really, really bad. And then there's other guys that, you know, they're just slightly above average all season. And to me, it seems like they may have more of a, have figured out how to maintain their performance, even though they might not have the type of top end talent as some other dudes like Machado or whatever. So I'd kind of like looked into basically like how big like a guy's performance deviated from a given week. And it was interesting just to kind of compare different guys based on how like volatile they were from week to week. But I had thought that the better you can kind of track, I guess, either, you know, what I was connecting to when things are going right, or what are the external / internal feels or cues that I was using, being able to track that as a way to try to eliminate the natural valleys of a season.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many good things that you brought up there. First, I want to plug our episode with Brian Pazos, because he talks about, like, we started that whole conversation off about keeping a journal. And I think each athlete, like, there's benefit to doing that. And Brian kind of talked a little bit about, like, the days that he was going the best, he didn't have a whole lot to write in there. And so I think that may be speaking to what you were talking about before of, like, when things are going well, sometimes it's really hard to put your finger on it. Or it can be just really keeping it simple, like your intention that day was, like, you had one intention and you were able to lock in on it and be in the moment. And so I think that keeping a journal can be a good way to actually be able to have some sort of data points. And I think we have to, with the whole data, you know, revolution, you know, we've talked about like what's good data versus not. People kind of knock subjective data, but subjective data can be very, very, very useful, because what a person is subjectively feeling is objectively true. And so, you know, as long as it's honest data, it's, that's really high quality data when it comes to an individual. And so, you know, one of the other things that like why keep a journal with that? And then also if you're able to collect wellness data, you collect what you did in practice, what you did in the weight room, you can then begin to look at all these different things and you can begin to see like, hey, what things may be influencing not just the mental state, but mm-hmm. what could be the other factors that are also influencing the, to use an ecological dynamics term, intrinsic dynamics, like what's going on internally with a person? What are those things that are influencing them? You know, like from an environmental standpoint, what could be influencing those intrinsic dynamics? So just another case for why you should collect as much data as you can.
Yeah, and I like that because I think there's a lot of value to, like you said, the subjective mm-hmm. data. But to me, like, and it's just kind of how I'm wired, like even with that, I want to see how we can like, you know, try to make it objective, right? So mm-hmm. one thing that I've always thought about was, okay, well, you could do some sort of like word cloud analysis of like what words are popping up the most whenever like he had stretches,
oh, sure.
stretches of good performance or bad performance or what cues, like what's the common themes, you know, mm-hmm. And then if you were to do like that with like a large group of people, then you start to understand, you know, we talked about clustering, you know, data together. So say we've got a certain type of hitter and we see kind of a trend with like a certain cue or a certain connection mm-hmm. to the environment for that type, then we know that there could be something significant to either the practice we're designing or the cues that we're giving. So I think it's a tough like pull because I think there's something, I don't know how to describe it. I'm sure there's been studies done. There's something different about actually writing it down with a pen.
Mm-hmm.
I think it does something in your brain where it maybe you become
then I need to write more.
More aware. Yeah. And people talk about the benefits of writing, but I just think from like the actual ability to maybe do some more interesting analysis,
mm-hmm.
Just like doing a journal, you know,
yeah,
in a computer or well, an iPad or whatever.
If you're able to do it in a like an iPad or something that can digitize it, like, but I mean, technology is getting so good that like even if you were to write it by hand, if you have the machine learning, you know, software, you can just scan it, and all that'll end up in the cloud, and man, there was just like, you just had a lot of good stuff there. I was trying to remember I had something to say, but I think there are some other things that you also wanted to cover.
Oh, no, I just wanted to brag on myself basically for, I guess, predicting that Cody Bellinger would win the MVP award, uh-huh. which was announced tonight.
Congrats to Cody.
Definitely congrats to him. It was a like just kind of a throwaway tweet, I guess, on my part, but because he, if I remember right, he kind of had like a monster first week.
Mm-hmm.
But I really started to like see something significant because I was learning at the time like when certain statistics or metrics specifically regarding hitters start to stabilize, and he had, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks in the season, and he had already reached like 60 plate appearances, and he had basically cut his strikeout rate in half. So it was like 24% the first 2 years of his career, and it was hovering at like 12%. So I'm like, with his pop and, you know, as hard as he hit the ball, and he was typically a, you know, line drive fly ball guy to begin with. And then the previous year, he had a really low, like, home run per fly ball rate. So he was due to regress in that area anyway. And he cut his strikeout rate in half. I'm like, this dude's going to be in for a monster season. Something significant has happened. And then his whole first half ended up, you know, being crazy. But yeah, I wanted to brag on myself for
correctly using, predicting. Using stats and statistics to inform your prediction.
Right, and there was also a particular member in the baseball hitting community that said that Bellinger didn't have the right hitting mechanics and that he would catch a few home runs every now and then. And then he goes on to become the MVP of the league. But of course, I mean, after his first half, then all of a sudden he had the right mechanics after saying that he didn't have the correct ones ahead of time. So,
yeah, I mean, that plays back to me, like when your body is calibrated or your perception is locked in. And by that, I mean, you know, when you're talking about like, maybe you are connecting the information well, but maybe your perception of where you are in space is not aligned with that. And so, for example, and I think I'll end up using this example a lot, and I probably already used it on the podcast, but like where your barrel is in space. So like if you're missing under or over, like I think a lot of coaches talk about being on time. And for me, it's like, okay, if we define being on time as hitting the ball out in front, you know, where you're going to have the highest exit velo, sure. But if we're just talking about simply getting on plane and then being in the hitting zone and running into a ball, it also means you can be on time and still miss the ball and swing under or over it.
Right.
And so to me, guys getting calibrated to different pitchers and understanding once you got yourself dialed in, you should be able to adjust well, but sometimes it takes a little bit. And so I think, you know, talking to guys, hey, you're under it, so that they can, you know, recalibrate and adjust. And I've even thought about like from a training standpoint, like having some rounds where we're throwing balls in different heights and they're able to not necessarily try to take a full swing, but to actually try to explore and try to utilize, find out like different ways to get to the ball, you know, and try some things in terms of like, hey, maybe I need a swing over the top of it. Maybe I need a swing for just slightly under or whatever, just so that like I do like sometimes stop swings, but I don't love them. But at the same point, like it helps from a calibration standpoint, I think it helps. It helps with body awareness of like understanding where your body is in space. Like if you can just touch the ball,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden it becomes easier to generally hit it.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, that's just calibration.
I like that. I think one thing that I would be interested in is it's almost hard to like miss on purpose, mm-hmm. you know, because you've never ever, you know, most people
right
have never even tried that.
Uh-huh.
So like I think it would be interesting to see just as far as like improving calibration is like, hey, like try to like miss over the top or try to miss under and just see like how well they can actually do that, you know, or miss like inside, like just like to get more of a feel for like where the barrel actually is in relation to the mm-hmm. ball. And I think that like you mentioned, like doing not like maybe full swings to do that, but I would even say like,
I think if you're doing full swings to try to intentionally miss, I think that's fine, but I don't know how much I like, cause I think to your point of most people are not trying to miss the ball when they swing.
Right.
So I do think there may be some merit in trying to swing and miss, but I actually think we should stick with the intention of trying to hit the ball and just utilize exploration to, like, this is where to me, that's why I have to define it in an ecological sense as calibration and exploration, because that then allows me to say we can slow it down. You know, and we don't have to take a full swing at full high effort, and we can actually do some more feel type stuff. And that's where I like ecological dynamics from the standpoint of it allows me to explain things in a logically consistent way. And it gives me a framework to stay logically consistent, because I think sometimes without having a good framework underneath, we can get some weird things that cognitively and logically don't actually align and run into conflict with it, with itself. So that's where, for me, I struggle with, should we intentionally try to swing and miss, unless it's an exploration standpoint, and what perceptual information can we get from that? I don't know. Like, that's where I kind of wonder.
I guess my only, the reason I would suggest it is because the swing is so ballistic anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So taking a 50% swing may not be representative enough to because you're trying to achieve accuracy,
mm-hmm,
in where you place the barrel in relationship to the ball. So if I'm accurately able to miss over the top and underneath and to the left and to the right or wherever,
mm-hmm,
then hopefully to hit the ball in the center, you can do the same type of thing, I guess so. And you're always doing that at full speed. So,
but I think the part of the benefit, and we know this from lifting, let's say I have you do a slower tempo movement, your body begins to neurologically connect and have more perception of the whole movement, instead of trying to get to certain points within the movement. And so that's where I think there's some benefit to doing things slower. I don't want to do everything slower because, again, in the book of dynamic, what is it? Dynamics of Skill Act book. They talk about phase shift. So you can't slow run. It just doesn't work. You can't run slowly. You're either walking or you're running.
Right.
And the in-between is just really awful place for you to be in. And they talk about it in terms of a phase shift. So if you're talking about finger wagging, essentially though, I think that's representative to a certain extent of throwing. Things don't sequence correctly if you go too slow.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get your arm into layback without throwing the ball.
Right.
It just doesn't work without the kinematics of that. And I think
you mean to tell me the tau drill is not an effective
yeah, for lots more reasons than just sequencing. But I think when I watch some hitters go move really slowly, they don't sequence correctly, they're all that sort of stuff, and then when what you're talking about, when you go fast, it sequences completely different. And it puts their body in positions that are more natural. And so I think, though, going somewhat sub-maximal, though, does allow for – it's a trade-off, right? You swing as hard as you can, you lose a little bit of accuracy. But if you swing sub-maximally, you begin to gain a little bit more accuracy and control and adjustability. And so that's where, for me, I think when we're trying to utilize or trying to – help athletes find new moves,
mm-hmm,
to having them slow down a little bit is okay from a exploration and calibration standpoint.
Would you prefer that still being off as a live look as possible?
Yes, absolutely.
So you would prefer, because I know we talked about this last week or whenever we last recorded,
mm-hmm,
we were talking about, or I was talking about people using T,
mm-hmm,
to incorporate new moves because they can kind of slow down,
yep,
more. So you would rather slow down a move while facing a live look instead of slowing down the live look and trying to complete the move full speed.
And the reason is that you want to couple the action to the information, because then it's now, if you even think about emotion and how emotion within a memory, when those similar circumstances come up, then those emotions come back. So that's only contextual. So moves are a little bit like memories. I'm not going to say they're 100% correlated, right? We were talking about that earlier. And we can maybe, if people are interested in R values and what's what a correlation, what is positively correlated or significant. But anyways, it being similar to the context shapes the movement, and once you tie it in with the information, then you can actually hopefully have a better transfer. And that's why, to me, in an ideal sense, I like the exploration to come in as live of a setting as possible, because then if it's successful, then we can start to connect it. Like, I can think, like, this is why, like, some guys look terrible in BP and then they get in a game, or like they're terrible in the bullpen and they get in a game and everything's locked in. I mean, the environment is completely different. And the environment, once they step on the mound, like, all of a sudden mind shifts, like, and then they're dialed in. And so, like, I think that's where we can get it closer to that environment. Those moves will transfer much better.
Yeah, I was pretty much the exact opposite, and I've got about like 40 college teammates that can vouch that I looked amazing in BP, and then the environment changed, and it was a little bit different.
Well, and that's where I think as a player, you want to be comfortable in the game.
Right. I would have traded. I would have much rather been a lot better in the game than just hitting.
Comfortable in practice.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's where the value of that is. So is there any other stuff that you were looking to cover this week?
I think that pretty much.
Unless we want to talk about R values, I'm sure everybody is dying to know about R values.
Look, I like it, but I know that a majority of the people
for sure
don't care for it. But I think there's value in kind of understanding.
Well, just when you like read other people's stuff, whether you're reading Driveline stuff, whether you're reading an actual study, having an understanding, because people use it to understand, I think that's where it's important for people to actually understand, versus just reading the adverbs that or adjectives that people put around those values, telling you that, oh, it is significant. So, you know, so people know, like, any number that is, the closer the number is to one, the higher the correlation. The closer it is to zero, the lower the correlation, or it to being not correlated. It can go positive or it can go negative. So if it's negatively correlated, it has an inverse effect, essentially. But then the question is at what level does it become significant? Mm-hmm. Like, you were telling me that 0.3, or was it 0.4?
I'm not even sure exactly what the actual cutoff is for a correlation coefficient being significant.
Yeah, to where, like, we can say it's correlated versus not correlated. I feel like that's really, really low. But then again, you're learning statistics, and I'll be taking statistics next semester as well. So
the big disclaimer is that correlation does not equal causation. So it's just because the relationship exists doesn't mean one is causing the other, and I think that's one thing a lot of people, not just coaches, get caught up in, is thinking that just because, you know, the two have a strong relationship, that one is causing the other. So you kind of have to, and this is kind of the whole point of the podcast even, is if we're looking at statistics, we got to do it in a logical framework where
we need to be honest with what statistics and science and data can do. Because I think that's, I now will not say any study proves anything. It doesn't. It helps us understand it a little bit better, and in a different way. Like, and that's where I think it was so easy to sell science as this thing that proves things. And it's like, no, it just gives us more information about it, and it leads to other questions. And so we can ask better questions, and we can make better, more informed decisions. That's what data and science does.
Yep.
If you're... Man, it's a great study if you end up proving something. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to join me again today.
Yeah.
And for our listeners at home for joining us as well. So if there's anything you wanted to add, I think we'll just wrap up and call it a day.
Yeah, sounds good. So again, follow us at GBoyum, I think it's 01 for Twitter, or GBoyum for Instagram, and then Brock can be found at Brock, was it 21?
That's right.
On Twitter. So follow us on Twitter, and then message us with, like, stuff that maybe you want us to cover or any feedback, we'd love feedback as well.
Yeah.
All right. Talk to you guys next time. Analyzing.